The Tom Woods Show, episode 952.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, chances are in your Facebook feed, you've got people telling you that you want children to die because you oppose Obamacare. Why, don't you know it saves 36,000 lives per year? Smash all this nonsense with my free ebook, Your Facebook Friends Are Wrong About Healthcare. Pick it up at yourfriendsarewrong.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. I am going to lose some listeners as a result of this episode. There's no doubt about it. No doubt about it. I'm going to lose some Catholic listeners who are going to be too sensitive, or they're not going to understand the limits of papal authority, or I don't know what, or they're extremely delicate, but I'm going to lose some. And it's a shame. I'm not trying to lose them. I'm not just provocative for its own sake, but sometimes things have to be said, and you have to just let the chips fall where they may. And the things we're going to say today are among those things. I am speaking today to George Neumeyer, who is a contributing editor at the American Spectator. He's formerly editor of Catholic World Report, and he is the author of a brand new book called The Political Pope: How Pope Francis is Delighting the Liberal Left and Abandoning Conservatives. Of course, Francis has been rather a bewildering figure for many observers, and Neumeyer has written a systematic account of his pontificate thus far. And it's interesting and important, which is why, of course, in certain parts of the Catholic world, let's say, it is not being given the attention it deserves. In fact, I think I'll start with that. George, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
The Political Pope, a very interesting book, and yet I don't want to say it's been blacklisted, but I do want to say that the conservative Catholic press has not exactly been shouting about it from the rooftops, and I wonder if you feel comfortable commenting on that. Is that a false impression on my part?
No, I don't think so. The secular press has actually taken more interest in my book than the Catholic press, at least in America. The international Catholic press has taken some interest in it. Marco Tozzotti, who's a very prominent Italian journalist who's covered the Vatican for decades, he has written about my book and endorsed it, as well as Carlo Franza, an Italian intellectual who writes for Il Giornale, and several other international, like the Catholic Herald in Britain has mentioned my book, To the Point magazine in Poland, which is a major Polish magazine. They did a 3-page interview with me. But the American conservative Catholic press has pretty much completely ignored it. A few traditionalists here and there, like 1P5 has mentioned the book, or they did an interview with me. And a few traditionalists have mentioned the book. But for the most part, the so-called establishment conservative Catholic press has completely ignored it.
Can you try to account for that, especially for listeners who might not know the political ins and outs of the church and particularly the Catholic right?
I guess I would describe it as a kind of right-wing political correctness. The American conservative Catholics in America, I guess at the end of the day, they tend to choose papalatry over the defense of the faith. You know, they would rather, you know, they don't want to be seen being too critical of the Pope. And they probably think that my book is over the top. I forgot. Maureen Malarkey did a review of my book in The Federalist, which is that's a secular online publication. And I appreciate that she went to the trouble of reviewing my book, you know, and engaging the book. But she basically took a negative view of my book. She thought I was being overly polemical and preaching to the choir and that sort of thing. So, you know, maybe that's the view of my book on the conservative Catholic right. I'm not sure. I don't know where exactly to place her. She says in the review that she shares my distaste for this pontificate, but I think it turns out that she really doesn't share my distaste for this pontificate, at least not my theological distaste for this pontificate. And I would say that her objection to Pope Francis is more political than theological.
Well, there is a key theological point that a lot of people who are not Catholic would be interested in, and that is the popularity of liberation theology, which was on the outs, let's say, for quite a long time. And there were statements on it that came from the CDF, the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith. But it seems to be enjoying a bit of a renaissance under Pope Francis. And I wonder if you can comment, what exactly is liberation theology? And is he simply slowly rehabilitating people, or is he actively endorsing liberation theology? What's he doing to make it seem more acceptable?
Well, at the very least, yeah, you can say he's been systematically rehabilitating all of the condemned liberation theologians from the Pope John Paul II era. Leonardo Boff, for example, the Brazilian liberation theologian who was removed from the priesthood because of his environmental activism, or at least was, I'm not sure if he quit on his own or was forced out, but basically he left the priesthood because he was engaging in all these environmentalist hijinks, and the Vatican got sick of that and condemned him. Well, Leonardo Boff has been completely rehabilitated by Pope Francis, and Francis enlisted Boff as an advisor to Laudato Si's encyclical on climate change. And according to Boff, Francis contacted him at one point and said, I'd like to see your plans for world government at the UN, because Boff has come up with this world government style plan for extracting payments from all the countries of the world to fight climate change. And according to Boff, Francis contacted him and said he wanted to see his plans for that. So that's just an example. That's just one of many examples of liberation theologians that this pontificate has, been rehabilitating. The father of liberation theology, Gustavo Gutierrez, he was one of the first guests at the Vatican in 2013. And, he was welcomed to the Vatican, and the Osservatore Romano, the Vatican newspaper, declared that he was an impeccable thinker and responsible for one of the most important theological currents of the 20th century. And so, what we can say, I think it's fair to say that a total rehabilitation of the condemned liberation theology of the 80s has taken place under this pontificate.
And also he'll say things, we could just have a whole discussion of the strange things that he says. And in fact, I don't even want to, I think it's dignifying them to call them strange, because they're only strange if you assume he means to say something sensible, true, Catholic, whatever, but maybe he doesn't. And so in that case, maybe they're not strange. But I don't know how to account for, I've met many Marxists who are good people. Now, has he said, I've met many traditional Catholics who are good people, or I've met many supporters of the free market who are good people, or I've met many wealthy people who are good people? I don't hear any of that, right? I mean, maybe I'm just not listening.
Yeah, well, one of the most telling tweets he ever sent out was, inequality is the root of all evil.
Right. I was going to ask you about that. Yeah.
Which you could imagine Karl Marx tweeting that out, but no Catholic Pope would ever say something that ridiculous because, we've been taught, through sound theology that inequality is actually sort of baked into the universe. And it was Satan's refusal to accept inequality that led to the fall of man. And, reality is hierarchical, which means that reality is unequal in the sense that not everything is the same. And if we don't see that we're creatures and God is the creator, and we don't accept that his will prevails over our own will and we should conform our will to his, then, that was the essence of the revolt against God. And that's why Saul Alinsky, in Rules for Radicals, dedicates his book to Satan. And he says Satan was the first socialist. He was the first champion of the have-nots. And so when the Pope tweets out inequality is the root of all evil, to me, it reveals that deep down he is much more of a socialist than he is a Catholic.
All right, well, that's going to scandalize some people. But, I mean, either you have to have a lobotomy as a Catholic or you're allowed to say what's obviously right in front of your eyes. Now, what could we have known about who Pope Francis would become based on what we could find out about who Jorge Mario Bergoglio was?
Yeah, I go into his background in Argentina in the book, and I think one of the most revealing biographical details about Jorge Bergoglio is that his mentor was a full-blown communist, a Paraguayan communist named Esther Balestrina. She was his boss at a lab in Buenos Aires. He was a kind of minor assistant at this lab, and she turned out to be his boss, and she was this very active communist revolutionary. She was from Paraguay, but she was active in Argentinian politics. And by his own admission, Bergoglio says that she played a very large role in shaping his political education. She introduced him to communist publications. She introduced him to communist thinkers. He said that he read about the Rosenbergs because of clippings that she had handed him. So, just like Obama's, formation was, critical to his formation was his relationship with Franklin Marshall Davis, the communist out in Hawaii. The same holds true for Bergoglio. There's a parallel here. Bergoglio too, also had a communist mentor. And he also, by his own admission, he also had communist teachers whom he admired and whom he learned a lot from. So the exposure to hardcore leftism and socialism, communism in Argentina is very important to consider and to look at when thinking about Bergoglio and why he has the ideological instincts that he does have.
Your book is called The Political Pope, yet there is material in here that's not, some people might not think is strictly political in the sense of involving government policy. There's plenty of stuff about the internal workings of the church. So why the name The Political Pope?
To convey the idea that he's more interested in left-wing politics than in Catholic theology. His political left-wing political dilettantism is unusually aggressive and really is the signature, is the defining mark of his pontificate. He's much more interested in saving the planet, quote unquote, than saving souls. And to that extent, he's a completely political pope. He's not a theological pope. He takes no interest whatsoever in teaching the faith, teaching theology. And in fact, he's told people around him that he finds theology to be boring. So really what makes what gets him up in the morning is the promotion of left-wing politics. And you can see that. I mean, I've talked to people, and there are many interviews in the book with priests and others which confirm this. But I recently was talking to a bishop off the record. He wouldn't want to be quoted, but he told me that he was just shocked by the way Bergoglio lives. That he described his living arrangement at the Vatican as just ridiculous and absurdly casual, and that he's spending his days not really in prayer, but in just sort of hanging out at the Vatican cafeteria and talking to anybody about politics who happens to come upon him. And the other day, he gave an interview to Eugenio Scalfari, the communist journalist in Italy. And the whole point of his summoning Scalfari to the Vatican for this interview was to denounce the United States and say that the United States had a distorted view of the world and that Europe needed to have a federal structure, a federal kind of United States of Europe structure in order to be a counterweight to the United States. So that just shows how aggressively political he is. I know a lot of popes in the past could be described as political, but I would say the political activity and the clericalism of this pope is on a completely different level.
All right. Now, you're saying some extremely controversial things, and far from pulling you back, I'm going to push you forward. Because I guess I would say, and I know you want to keep your eye on the ball here. You want to focus on Pope Francis, and you want to talk to a lot of Catholics who have very fond memories of previous popes, particularly John Paul II. But I guess the way I look at it is, if it hadn't been for John Paul II, there would have been no Pope Francis. If it hadn't been for these, again, I'm not going to say bewildering, like it's a mystery that they appointed these people. They obviously knew what they were doing. Absolutely terrible people have been appointed as bishops all over the world. Horrible people, people who should be sweeping floors somewhere, are running the Catholic world. It's not a surprise that you wind up with a Bergoglio, with a Francis as pope. If you're going to appoint Jorge Mario Bergoglio over the people of Buenos Aires and say, that's a good decision, I'm glad I'm doing that, then I guess, I mean, we have no right to be surprised or think that this is an anomaly when this is the kind of person who's been appointed. People in the Catholic world have suffered under Bergoglios for decades now. And it's not because of Pius XII. Over his dead body would a guy like Bergoglio have been appointed. So where does the buck stop?
Yeah, I agree that Bergoglio is the culmination of decades of liberal softness and socialist infiltration in the Catholic Church, which conservative popes like John Paul II and unfortunately Benedict XVI didn't do enough to uproot. And you're right, a lot of bad bishops got in during the last two pontificates before Bergoglio's. And that's one of the reasons why he was allowed to become pope. The College of Cardinals is full of liberals.
So then maybe John Paul II wasn't that conservative after all. Because, I mean, would you have appointed any of those bishops? Would you have named Bergoglio? Then why are we letting him off the hook? I mean, I'm sorry I keep pushing you in that direction, but I feel like I have to.
Well, I think, I think it's fair to say that John Paul II and Benedict XVI, to a certain extent, were lax. And they didn't do a sufficient job of confronting the modernist crisis in the church. But does that mean that they're liberals cut out of the same cloth as Bergoglio? No. Both John Paul II and Benedict were formed by the pre-Vatican II church, and they had a certain measure of sympathy for it, whereas Bergoglio has no sympathy for it. He is a product of the Vatican II church. He was ordained, I believe, the year after Vatican II ended. So he's a son of Vatican II in a way that John Paul II and Benedict weren't. And he's completely committed to completing the project of the so-called Spirit of Vatican II, which is to try and incorporate as much of modern liberalism as possible into Catholicism project. And you could say, I think people can say that because of the weakness of the last two pontificates before his, you know, the modernists got the ball to like the 30-yard line, and now Bergoglio thinks he can run it into the end zone. And I don't know, maybe he can, because there are the unfortunate reality is that there are very few determined anti-modernists in the College of Cardinals. And that's really what you would need to stop this liberal revolution. You would need the cardinals to stand up and say, the modernist movement is a massive crisis in the church. We have to eradicate it completely. And, I mean, here's one small example of how Bergoglio came about, as I understand it. Maybe somebody could correct me here, but Cardinal Casper was turned 80 the week that Benedict resigned, I believe. So technically, he should not even been allowed to vote in the conclave. For your listeners, Casper is a very liberal German cardinal. So Benedict, if he had wanted to, could have told Casper, sorry, but you can't vote in the next conclave. You know, it's according to the rules, you're too old. But that didn't happen. They gave him a waiver, and he voted in the conclave. And, of course, he was one of the great champions of Bergoglio. And all these sort of semi-conservative rubber stamp types at the conclave just listened passively as the Caspers were touting Bergoglio aggressively. And they just went along with it. And on the basis of, you know, very little information and a silly five-minute speech that Bergoglio gave about a quote-unquote self-referential church, and, you know, this, they, you know, showed no due diligence at all in selecting him as the next pope. And now some of these guys are feeling some buyer's remorse, and probably at the next conclave, they're going to want to go with somebody safer. But, you know, yeah, you're right. This is the culmination of a century of liberal softness in the church at the very least, but not documented in the book. There was a serious left-wing infiltration, socialist infiltration of the church, and modernist, theologically modernist infiltration of the church, which goes back over a century. And so Bergoglio's election was really not about the future of Catholicism. It was about the past of Catholicism. His election marked the victory of the modernists in a war that had raged for over a century and that the conservatives had fought very weakly.
Well, just to amplify a bit of what you're saying about the differences between Francis and John Paul II, I did think it was significant, the way you discussed it in your book, about the canonization of John Paul II, that Francis decided to pair that with the canonization of John the 23rd. Now, to my knowledge, there is no global following of John the 23rd. I know of no organized movement to pray to him for miracles or anything like that, or devotion to him. I would say most people in America probably never even heard of John the 23rd, but it seems like a way to water down the canonization of John Paul II, about whom Francis said very little. And interestingly, with all those Poles there, he says nothing about Poland whatsoever. Very odd.
Right. Yeah. And the Poles are still furious about it. They felt terribly insulted by the way in which he conducted the canonization ceremony. They felt he was just phoning it in. And that, yeah, by coupling it with this liberal, the liberal pope, that was his way of diluting the canonization of John Paul II. And they resent it. And they think that he, yeah, it was in interpreted widely as a snub. And another thing, I mean, to take into account, why, you know, the question is why would he be so rude? And my theory is that there are two things he didn't like about John Paul II. Number one, he didn't like that John Paul II went after the liberation theologians in Latin America. He didn't like the anti-communism of John Paul II. And that's the other thing is he didn't like the John Paul II's description of modernity as a culture of death. And obviously, you know, one of the first things that Bergoglio said when he became pope was the church stopped talking about abortion or talk less about abortion and gay marriage and contraception. So that was an indirect condemnation of John Paul II and Benedict XVI.
Now, meanwhile, in terms of the internal church matters, we read stories about appointments and sackings, and he's going to clear out this group and that group and this demote this person and whatever. Can we clearly see a pattern of people who were conservative, at least in the post-Vatican II sense? There's almost no people who would be considered conservative in the hierarchy of the church in a pre-Vatican II sense. But nevertheless, even the conservatives of that stripe, are they being systematically replaced by people who are loyal to Francis?
Oh, yeah, there's no question that a conservative purge is being conducted by Bergoglio and his people. And they're just, and Mueller was one of the last Benedict guys to be tossed out, you know, and the significance of his firing or sacking is that Pope Francis now feels finally that he's sort of free of all the conservative restraints from the Benedict era. And now that Mueller's gone, and now he feels that he can pursue his projects without any sort of resistance. And what I've been told is that the few sort of placeholder Benedict era placeholders that are still there, they've been completely frozen out, and they have no real input. And the people with real power at the Vatican are all modernists whom Bergoglio selected.
Yeah. Now, do we know anything about his governing style? I've heard anecdotally that he governs with an iron hand, even though he gives this image of being extremely humble and a very sweet person, that behind closed doors, he's anything but.
Yeah, that's exactly what I've heard, that he operates like a low-level Argentinian politician. And, you know, that I think that's one of the reasons why people call him the Peronist Pope, is that he behaves like a left-wing autocrat in the Latin American style. And so he'll call people. This one priest told me a story about how his friend was once yanked out of a meeting very rudely by Francis and then chewed out for, you know, making comments that Francis perceived as, you know, being critical of him. It was a completely trivial matter. It was just a petty power play kind of thing. So yeah, he's doing stuff like that all the time. And, you know, Mueller's criticism of the Pope's handling of his sacking, it really didn't go to the theological implications of it. It went to the personal implications of it. He felt that Francis had treated him in a very high-handed way and fired him the minute after his term and didn't give him any reason for firing him. So and so Mueller said, when is the church's teaching on social justice applied to Vatican employees? And so that just tells you, you know, how vindictive and thuggish he can actually be.
And yet, just because I think it would be interesting, let me mention something quite anomalous, nevertheless, in all of this. I want to say something about, and I'm going to introduce it to the audience here, the Society of St. Pius X, which is an order of priests going back quite some time, at least to the 1970s, whose head was the now deceased Archbishop Marcel Lefebvre, who had been an African missionary. And he was of the opinion that the traditional liturgy of the church needed to be preserved. We needed to ordain priests who were going to hold fast to that. Not to mention he had some doctrinal problems with the Second Vatican Council. So they existed in an irregular canonical situation for a long time. And then in 1988, when there were negotiations going on with the Vatican that broke down, Lefebvre went ahead and ordained four bishops, basically without the Pope's authority. And therefore, at least according to some canonists, incurred excommunication late sententiae. And so he and his bishops, although not his faithful, were said to have been excommunicated. And so they were in a highly irregular situation. John Paul II then gave a limited permission to have the traditional mass of the church that had been modified after Vatican II available to faithful requesting it. And bishops didn't go along with that very well. Then Benedict XVI said, well, you don't even have to ask your bishop. Anybody can celebrate the old liturgy. But the Society of St. Pius X is still around. The last I heard about, they had at least 1 million faithful. They have many priests. They have churches all over the place. They are still not in a regular canonical situation. But my point is, they're very traditionalist. And Francis seems to be quite interested in reaching some kind of an agreement with them. Now, on the other hand, the dates by which this agreement was supposed to have been announced and implemented have come and gone, as they have for the past 20 years. But how do you account for his apparent desire to see that through, even though normally these are people he would strongly dislike?
I actually think it's part of a somewhat devious plan to ghettoize the old mass. That's my theory, and maybe I'm wrong, but I think there's some reason to think that one of his motivations here is he wants to keep the Latin mass, the old mass, within one personal prelature run by the Society of Pius X, and he wants to take it out of the so-called mainstream parishes, and just he wants to say to all the Latin mass going Catholics in those mainstream parishes, well, if you want that mass, you should go to a Society of Pius X church. So I think this will actually end up weakening the Latin mass movement in church. It could end up ghettoizing it. And I have no problem with the Vatican regularizing the relationship with Society of Pius X. That's not my point. My point is that this is, I wouldn't trust Francis's motivations here. And I think the cardinals and the bishops should make it crystal clear to Bergoglio that they will not accept his ripping up Summorum Pontificum, which mainstream the traditional Latin mass throughout the Catholic Church, and that movement cannot be stopped by any kind of overtures to the Society of Pius X.
I personally think that Pope Emeritus, such a crazy title, Benedict XVI ought to offer the traditional Latin mass publicly, despite his insistence that he's going to be humble and invisible. He hasn't really been invisible, so that he can get over that hang-up, I think, easily enough. But something to send some kind of a message to the Catholic world. What has he got to lose? What is he, 90 years old? What on earth has he got to lose at this point? Why doesn't he do it?
Yeah.
Why doesn't he say something?
One of the things I mentioned in the book is this little a report that Sandro Magister put out very early on in the pontificate of Bergoglio, which was that Benedict XVI was very upset by Pope Francis's harassment of the Franciscan Friars of the Immaculate, the order in Italy that was using the old mass, and Francis made it clear to them that he wanted them to stop using the old mass, and so he sent a representative to kind of harass them and make sure that the order didn't become a traditional Latin mass order. So Sandro Magister, who's an Italian journalist, he reported that a visitor to Benedict asked him about the treatment of the Franciscan friars, and that Benedict said to him that he thought that Bergoglio's behavior was completely contrary to Summorum Pontificum. And I don't think that reporting has ever been refuted. So I think, privately, Benedict XVI looks at the hostility of Bergoglio to the old mass. He probably thinks that that's a bad thing.
Yeah, but and it's going to take more than that.
He would need to. Of course he should make his, as crazy as it might be, he should make his criticisms of Bergoglio known somehow. And one way to do it would be to say the old mass publicly.
Yeah. And I mean, then he can at least die in peace. At peace with himself.
I have a whole chapter in my book dedicated to documenting the reversals by Bergoglio of all the policies of his predecessors. And there are multiple reversals.
Yeah, even if the malarkey criticism of your book were true, that it's just preaching to the choir, even if that were true, the choir doesn't follow every single detail. I mean, you're a journalist. You're interested in the church. You used to be, you were editor of Catholic World Report. Isn't that right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So you know this stuff better than any layman does, than any ordinary layman would. And so for you to be able to just collect it in one place and show this isn't just an isolated newspaper report here and there, this is a systematic program, well, that can open people's eyes. That's very important in and of itself.
Right. I mean, yeah, that people need to grapple with the information in the book. And if, I document all of the informational, claims that I make in the book. So if they want to, I think anybody, even a critic of, or, you know, even a admirer of Pope Francis might find the book useful. It's a systematic description of his 4-year pontificate. And it highlights all the really seminal, critical moments of his pontificate, which people can debate. Nobody's done this so far. All the books on Pope Francis before my book, fell into the category of hagiography, really. And my book is the first book to attempt to be candid about his pontificate and to look at not just the, soft highlights of it, but the, all of the critical moments of it.
All right. I want to close with this question. Give me two scenarios. One is the scenario you'd like to see happen. What's the best case scenario that's realistic that you'd like to see unfold in the church over the next few years, whether it's cardinals standing up to the Pope or whatever? Or what do you fear is going to be the condition of the church 3, 5, 10 years hence?
Well, this might sound glib, but the best case scenario that I could envision would be if the Pope converted to Catholicism, because it's pretty clear that he has very serious objections to Catholicism, and that he's much more of a Protestant in his theology than he is a Catholic. So it would be if he were to, somehow undergo some sort of conversion away from modernism towards Catholicism and took his responsibilities as teacher of the faith seriously and taught the faith in an orthodox manner, that would be the best outcome. But I think that's highly unlikely, unfortunately. And so I think the next scenario, the more realistic scenario, he's going to continue to drive a wedge between Catholics and their faith. And that's going to cause a sort of unfolding chaos in the church. And there's the conclusion of his pontificate is going to be very dramatic and very ugly. And I frankly don't know how it will end, except that I know that it will be very ugly, because what he's doing to the Catholic Church is ugly. And Catholics are going to have to decide whether they value the faith over papalatry, whether preserving the integrity of the faith is more important to them than maintaining this sort of phony appearance of unity. And the cardinals are going to have to decide whether they're really defenders of the faith or not. And if they do make that decision, then they have only one choice, and that is to declare to the faithful that, the current pope is a bad pope and he must be resisted for the good of the faith. And what specific forms, I'm not sure, and I'm not even sure what to recommend. All I know is that, at the very least, he's a material heretic. It's impossible to say he's a formal heretic, because you have to in his heart and in his mind. And that's that's hard to say. But if he were to respond to the dubia, the Cardinal Burke and the three others who wrote that dubia to him, and if he were to stand up and say, look, I disagree with church teaching on divorce and remarriage. I just think the church has been wrong on this and the church needs to change her teaching. Well, at that point, the cardinals would know that he's a formal heretic. And then they could, as Robert Bellarmine and other church theologians over the centuries have said, the cardinals could stand up and say, well, the Pope has committed himself to formal heresy, and therefore he's automatically self-vacated the chair of St. Peter, and therefore we can move to fill the chair of St. Peter with a new Pope. That is the ultimate, most dramatic scenario that could happen. But, I have no idea. I my guess is that he'll never answer the dubia. And so he's going to, make it impossible for anybody to identify him as a formal heretic.
Well, and that's just it. Even though he's obviously no intellectual, I mean, he's not in any way impressive as a thinker. Nevertheless, he's cagey and smart enough to know that you don't just come out and say, no, I disagree with church teaching. Modernists never do that. It's always, the church's tradition must be respected. Of course, in current circumstances, we have to understand and be sensitive to blah, blah, blah. It's always something, or it's always some one phrase in paragraph 87.
Yeah,
that they blow up into the meaning of the whole document. It's never outright there are four persons in the Trinity. They wouldn't try that.
Right.
Although you would find the same people who are blacklisting your book on the conservative Catholic right, if the Pope did come out and say there were four persons in the Trinity, they would be saying, well, you know, isn't that implicitly what we've believed all along? I mean, yeah. You just cannot have too low an estimate of some of these people.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Here's what he really meant by four.
Yeah, but, right. Exactly.
But his advisor said under, you know, Antonio Spadaro, the Jesuit editor of that Vatican-approved Jesuit publication in Rome, he said, you know, under Francis, 2 + 2 now equals 5. And that really is the relativism of this pontificate.
Yeah.
And they're just throwing out all sorts of ambiguous, contradictory statements, doing all sorts of contradictory things. But they're not, yeah, issuing a press release saying we reject church teaching on divorce and remarriage. Instead, they're saying things like, oh, well, Amoris Laetitia is perfectly consonant with church tradition and church orthodoxy. We only disagree on how to apply the teaching and things like that, which, of course, is nonsense. It's a complete rejection of church teaching. And the rejection is made known through a footnote, you know, in which the Pope is endorsing adultery. He says in a footnote that, you know, adulterous couples would have a hard time maintaining their marriage if they couldn't continue to commit adultery. That's what he put in the footnote. And that there you see the rejection of church teaching. But as Archbishop Bruno Forte, one of the advisors to that document, said to the press, he said that Francis came to him and said, we can't make our opposition explicit. You know, we can't change teaching explicitly. We have to do it subtly. And we have to kind of indirectly put the premises in the document, then let others pastorally work them out. And then Forte made the funny comment. He said, well, this is typical of a Jesuit. So the situation ethics of this Pope is being advanced Jesuitically. You know, it's not through press releases and overt direct statements, but through footnotes and making these sort of vague pastoral noises about how we need to be more understanding and things like that. And who am I to judge? And so all that together just ends up driving a wedge between the Catholics and their faith. And that really, does it really matter if that's the way you get there rather than issuing press releases? So I think the modernists move the ball downfield slowly, but they continue to move the ball downfield.
Well, I'll just say, I remember early on in the pontificate when he would say things that were shocking to people. And then we'd get this clarification from either, I don't know, the Vatican press office or in L'Osservatore Romano, the mouthpiece of the Vatican, saying, well, what he really meant was blah, blah, blah. And this just kept happening. He meant this. And I kept saying, whoever's issuing these clarifications, why don't we just appoint that guy, the Pope? You know, just cut out the middleman. Let's have this guy. So anyway, well, I'm sorry it has to be under such tragic and horrifying circumstances, but I'm glad that you and I had a chance to talk and particularly about your book, which I think, you know, people are going to find to be not a boring read. It's called The Political Pope, How Pope Francis is Delighting the Liberal Left and Abandoning Conservatives. And the conservatives who have been abandoned are so shell-shocked and yet still so devoted to the cult of the papacy, they won't even listen to this to what George is trying to tell them. But you should, and you'll find this very informative. And indeed, it reads like a novel, but it's all too real. Best of luck with it, George, and thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
All right, everybody, that is our episode for today. So I'll have to see how many listeners I've still got, but I appreciate you giving this a respectful listen. And you should check out George Neumeyer's book without a doubt. And I hope you have a nice weekend. Next weekend it's going to be about episode 958. It's a bonus episode on music. Yes, it is recorded and in the can. So wait for that baby to come out as a bonus next weekend. This weekend, just relax and listen to Contra Krugman, which will be out this weekend. That's the other podcast I do. I do that one just once a week with Bob Murphy, and we critique Paul Krugman. New one comes out every weekend, so check that out at ContraKrugman.com, and I'll see you next week.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.